Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Did you see President Obama's speech last night? I dare say much of America did. He's only given us two speeches from the Oval Office in his 7 years as president. It was a pretty important one and fairly compelling, I have to say. I thought in general it was a good speech. I very much appreciated what he had to say about distinguishing between the good, normal, peaceful 1 billion Muslims all around the world and those that have gone to a perverted form of Islam, that of jihadi Islam. Actually, let's play that part of the clip from President Obama. Let's go ahead and play that.
We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. That does not mean denying the fact that an extremist ideology has spread within some Muslim communities. It's a real problem that Muslims must confront without excuse. The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it. We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk, or abandoning our values, or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power. We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. That, too, is what groups like ISIL want. ISIL does not speak for Islam. They are thugs and killers, part of a cult of death. And they account for a tiny fraction of a more than a billion Muslims around the world, including millions of patriotic Muslim Americans who reject their hateful ideology. It is the responsibility of all Americans, of every faith, to reject discrimination. It is our responsibility to reject religious tests on who we admit into this country. It's our responsibility to reject proposals that Muslim Americans should somehow be treated differently. Because when we travel down that road, we lose. That kind of divisiveness, that betrayal of our values, plays into the hands of groups like ISIL. Muslim Americans are our friends and our neighbors, our co-workers, our sports heroes. And yes, they are our men and women in uniform who are willing to die in defense of our country. We have to remember that. Let's not forget that freedom is more powerful than fear. That we have always met challenges, whether war or depression, natural disasters or terrorist attacks, by coming together around our common ideals as one nation and one people. So long as we stay true to that tradition, I have no doubt that America will prevail.
Now that was well said, Mr. President. That was beautifully put. All except one thing. It was a glorious symphony with one discordant note. I'll get to that note in a second. Let's first of all talk about the symphony. He's absolutely right. ISIS wants this to be a war between America and Islam, and it is not. To suggest in any way that ISIS represents Islam is indeed a victory for ISIS that would like very much to represent Islam, but is instead, as President Obama put it, an extremist ideology spread in some Muslim communities. It should not define all of Islam. Most Muslims don't want that. Most Americans don't want that, nor should we. They want this to be a war on Islam, and it is not. Not in the least. Indeed, when President Obama says to make it a war against American Muslims, we all lose. That's true in a variety of senses. It's true primarily in the sense of who America is as a nation. We are a country of immigrants. We are a country of people from all over the world. We are a country that has a First Amendment where Congress cannot establish a single religion. We have many culturals. It is indeed our strength, our diversity. That's all true. In fact, if you look at the killers in San Bernardino and you compare them to, say, the killers in France, both inspired by ISIS, I think there may be a slight difference. I think the French killers may have actually been from ISIS, whereas the killers in San Bernardino were inspired by ISIS. But one of the things that I found so interesting is that the killer in France, at least some of them, were born in France, grew up in France, were inspired by some of the inequities that occurs in France. Not that anything that happened in Paris was in any way justified. But there's a lot more anger and disaffectedness among French Muslims than among Americans. And I think that's precisely because France is a relatively monolithic culture. There's one language, French. There's the vast majority are Catholics. There's a very distinct French culture. Whereas America is, to use the French word, a mélange of cultures, a mixture. American Muslims are every bit as American as American Jews, American Christians, American Buddhists, American Hindus, American atheists, American agnostics, and 7,000 other religions that I don't have time to name on this show. That's the beauty of America. That's why we don't have disaffected Muslim populations. That's why, for a long time, the terrorists had to come here rather than grow up here. Now, this man who was a citizen may have been, we'll find out more, may have been, what's the word they use, radicalized by his wife, who was recently from Saudi Arabia, had just been trained, had only been here a few months. But I think that, too, tells you something about the difference between America and France and other nations around the world. It requires someone who's recently radicalized. The 9/11 terrorists were newly here. Because once you live among our multicultural diversity that should recognize and celebrate people of all faiths and colors and walks of life, it's very hard to do a terrorist attack against Americans, and that's the way it should be. When President Obama says we all lose, obviously we would lose the sense of freedom and First Amendment and human dignity that gives everyone due process if we were to turn against all Muslims or do as, I guess, Donald Trump somehow proclaims we should do, which is to track them all, put them all on some kind of watch list. Not the terrorist watch list, but a Muslim watch list. Not a list of people who have been radicalized into believing that a bunch of people, innocent people, should die. That'd be the terrorist watch list. But just simply a group of people of all of a certain heritage. That would be a problem. It's not just that that would cause a great affront to American values. It would also harm us in the war on terrorism. Because to push away an entire population is to do precisely ISIS's bidding, to radicalize loyal Americans into becoming disloyal and possibly mass killers. Now, maybe it wouldn't happen. Indeed, when we interned 100,000 innocent Japanese Americans in World War II, extremely few turned against their country, being the United States, of course, their country. But still, I think with Europe as the model, we do not need to cause a disaffected population of any group, of any minority. We have enough trouble with mistreatment of blacks and Latinos and other minorities in America without adding Muslims to the mix. So all of that, everything the president said, save one note, was, I think, entirely correct. We'll go on later in the broadcast with other things he said that I agree with, namely to help keep guns from getting in the hands of terrorists, and his request for Congress to give him authorization for his war against ISIS, both of which were exactly right. We'll get to those. So what was the one discordant note? The one time I thought President Obama was being a little too flip, taking things a little bit too far. It's when he said that he will destroy ISIS. He just said it. I guess with a global coalition, he's bombing the heck out of them. He thinks he's going to destroy ISIS that way. I fear that President Obama, and it's not just President Obama, it's also the Republicans who oppose him in Congress. I fear that neither of them has a sophisticated understanding of what this conflict is all about, or if they have it, they're not willing to express it to the American people. People ask all the time, even Donald Trump asks, it's a reasonable question to ask, where are the moderate Arab nations? Those in the Middle East, those who often fund ISIS, those whose citizens often join ISIS. Where is Saudi Arabia? Where are the Gulf states? Where are the Sunni Arab nations that you would think would oppose this Sunni Muslim extremist terrorist group, namely ISIS? Okay, Al-Qaeda largely supports them, although even Al-Qaeda has written off ISIS as being particularly gruesome. Al-Nusra, Hamas, okay, these are terrorist groups. We expect them to be loyal to another Sunni terrorist group. But what about Saudi Arabia, this great ally of ours? Kuwait, we went to war to protect Kuwait from Iraq. Why aren't Sunni Muslims joining in? And if you don't understand that, then you don't understand why it's going to be virtually impossible, in my view, to defeat ISIS. I'm glad President Obama won't send troops in because they couldn't win. This is not like a conventional army where you defeat it with troop movements. There's some of that. ISIS controls some territory. That's possible to some extent. But I think this is much more like Vietnam in the sense that it's an ideology we're fighting against. We could kill a million Viet Cong and new ones propped up every day. They weren't inspired by our rhetoric of democracy versus communism, particularly when the so-called Democrats we were supporting in South Vietnam were plenty corrupt themselves. For them, it was the idea of an invader, namely us, versus the native Vietnamese people, and on that ground, we could never win the war in Vietnam. To understand ISIS, you have to actually look beyond their brutality, which is hard to do, because that's a flashing red light. You have to just understand where their support comes from. Why would relatively normal people support such a disgusting, blood-ridden ideology? I've talked about this before. I'm going to talk about it a little bit more when we come back from break. 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levin.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levin. And welcome back to KPHX Phoenix, Arizona, Arizona's premier talk radio station. You can hear 1480 AM every single day in this time slot. Also glad to have our listeners from Phoenix back with us. And folks, if you are from Phoenix and you call in, you will get first priority in honor of your station joining us this today and forevermore. So 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and give us a call, particularly you folks from Phoenix, and we'll make sure you get on track first. Before the break, I talked about the discordant note in President Obama's speech. And this is something that I've talked about in the past. But it's important to me because I turn on CNN, I turn on MSNBC, I turn on Fox. I read the New York Times, the Washington Post. I hear virtually no one saying what I'm about to say. And this comes out of, if you've been listening to the show for a while, 4 years of saying this same thing. And it's really something that I fear President Obama doesn't get or doesn't want to get. Now, to be fair, his Republican colleagues get it even less. Indeed, about the only one in national policy who I think really understands this, or at least better than anybody else, is Hillary Clinton. I believe that the person I believe will be the Democratic nominee. Don't want to jump the gun there. But I believe the woman who will be our next president, Hillary Rodham Clinton, does get this when she calls for a no-fly zone over Syria and disagrees with President Obama on this score. Think about the difference between what President Obama is doing, bombing the heck out of ISIS, and what Hillary Clinton suggests doing, a no-fly zone. The first, when you bomb people, you better get only the bad guys. And I hope he does. Because if you get some innocent people among those bad guys, that just leads to greater resentment and greater recruitment for ISIS. Hillary Clinton's idea is a no-fly zone. Frankly, something that I've been proposing since 2011. In Syria, back when no one was proposing anything except me. What does a no-fly zone do? A no-fly zone prevents not just ISIS, but more importantly prevents Assad, the dictator of Syria, and his allies, Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, from bombing towns, villages, city blocks all throughout Syria, murdering people, innocent people, just on the grounds that they are Sunni Muslim, because the Iranians and Hezbollah, they're Shia Muslim, and Assad is Shia as well, and Russia is happy to have their support because they get a basis. They get a base in Tarsus, which is a warm water port in Syria. ISIS's support does not come out of massive belief among Sunni Muslims, even Sunni Muslims in Syria and Iraq, that the West is terrible and needs to be destroyed. That's, I'm sure, the belief of the ISIS leadership. But the people who join the fight, who come all over the Sunni Arab world to join ISIS, aren't coming because they hate the United States. They aren't coming because they hate Israel. They're coming because their brothers and sisters and mothers and children and cousins are being bombed to death by Syria, Iran, and Russia. That's why they're joining ISIS. That's why they're learning and worshiping this warped ideology, which has blowback and ends up murdering a bunch of Westerners. If we only fight ISIS and don't fight Assad, Iran, and Russia, we will never defeat them. This is what President Obama gets wrong. This is what Hillary Rodham Clinton gets right. A no-fly zone would help provide a safe zone where the population of Syria, whether they be Sunni Muslim or Shia or Christian or Kurdish, could live their own lives free from fear. And once you create a place in Syria for people to live free from fear, there won't be refugees. ISIS will quickly wither away. This is the strategy that I wish President Obama would pick up on. This is Mark Levine. Give me a call. I'll be right back after this.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. You know, the complexities of this war on terrorism seem to be lost on everybody. And I don't mean just to pick on President Obama. For all the fact that I'm complaining that his war on terrorism strategy isn't as precise, perhaps, as I would like it to be, President Obama has clearly said he won't work with Assad. He won't work with Russia. He's made it very clear. This isn't a question of good guys and bad guys. ISIS is the bad guys and everyone else is the good guys. In Syria, there are about 12 different actors, and virtually all of them are bad guys. Iran, Russia, Hezbollah on one side, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, ISIS on the other side. And oh yes, there is the Free Syrian Army. I don't know how many are left alive. Hopefully more than five, most of whom are probably refugees. These are the Sunni Muslims who, back a couple years ago were a formidable force, back when I argued for a no-fly zone in 2011, were the moderate Syrian opposition designed to supplant Assad. Had they succeeded, ISIS wouldn't have a chance in heck. You'll recall that President Obama, though he didn't do the no-fly zone that I supported, did call for destruction of Assad's military after the Syrian dictator started to gas his own people with poison gas. At the last minute, he even called on Congress to join in the effort. You may remember a speech he gave from the White House calling on Congress to join him. And as a constitutional scholar, I have to say that is the right way to do it, although, to be fair, virtually every president has ignored that part of the Constitution, including President Obama in Libya, but definitely including George W. Bush, including Nixon. You can go way back. It is the right way to do it, although presidents have often ignored that. In any case, Congress turned him down flat. The same Republicans who are condemning his war on terrorism wouldn't even support him in fighting Assad over his chemical weapons, much less the hundreds of thousands that Assad has murdered by conventional means. So Republicans aren't out of this either. And I think if you look at President Obama's speech, one of the things he says to the Republicans, again, is authorize this. You think I need to take a tougher stand on terrorism? Authorize this. Authorize this. The authorization for use of military force that dates back to September 11th, 2001, or actually a few months afterwards, is old. It's outdated. It's 13 years ago. It's not much of an authorization. Congress, you want to have a role to play? Tell the president what you want him to do. Don't sit there and complain and then not act. But a lot of times Congress, particularly the Republicans who control Congress, they don't want to act because they might be wrong. It's much easier to complain about the president than it is to suggest a course of action yourself, which is why I've always suggested a course of action myself. I still believe a no-fly zone is the right idea, even though I fully recognize it would have been much easier to put in place 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, even last year, before the Russians got involved. Still, I think taking that strong stand with the support of our allies, particularly our NATO allies like Turkey, whose airspace was invaded by Russia recently, would help stop the murders that Assad is committing that's causing his populace in desperation to turn to a terrorist group like ISIS. Another element of the president's speech, and this one I fully support, has to do with guns. And I really ask everyone to take this terrorist attack in San Bernardino in perspective. It was awful. 14 people dead, 17 wounded. But compare it to a similar ISIS attack that occurred just this weekend on the London Underground, the metro, the subway. A deranged man, or maybe a sane terrorist, a man under the thrall of ISIS, unable to obtain a firearm, knifed three people. Latest account, thank God, all three people will live. Now, it's not pleasant to be knifed by a terrorist. But compare the score in London, zero dead, three wounded, zero seriously wounded, with the score in San Bernardino, 14 dead, 17 wounded, many seriously. The simple fact is, and you're really hard-pressed to argue this logically, guns do more damage than knives. I defy anyone to dispute the accuracy of that statement. Guns do more damages than knives. One terrorist with a knife can't do as much as one terrorist with a gun. Three terrorists with knives, I dare say, can't do as well as one terrorist with a gun. He couldn't get a gun in Britain. And now that we've compared a terrorist attack in the United States with a terrorist attack in Britain, let's compare a terrorist attack in the United States with everyday activity, gun deaths in the United States. More than 30,000 people every year in the United States die at the hand of guns. More than 30,000 people, where half the civilized world's gun deaths and 5% of its population. Now, I'm not including countries like El Salvador or Somalia or other places where anarchy reigns and everyone's killing everyone, but I am comparing us to Canada, England, France, Japan, Australia, Germany, people we think of as our peers. We don't often think of El Salvador or Somalia as our peers. And yes, they have even more guns than we do as Americans. And we have far, far, far more than the rest of the civilized world put together. I don't mean to say that El Salvadorans aren't civilized. I just mean to say that their government isn't very organized. They live in anarchy. You get my point. President Obama pointed out that one of the problems is that terrorists have very easy access to guns in America. And the Senate voted a very simple vote. It said, if you're on the no-fly list because the Attorney General has determined that you are a terrorist, so much a terrorist that we can't trust you on an airplane because we're afraid that with your bare hands, you're going to strangle a passenger. After all, you do have to go through a metal detector to get on an airplane. Your bags do have to go through very sophisticated explosive detecting devices, and that's a good thing. But we still won't let you on a plane because you might still do some damage. The Democrats said, the Senate said, if you are so much of a terrorist that we can't trust you to fly in the United States of America, then you shouldn't be able to buy a semi-automatic weapon of mass destruction like an AR-15 or an AK-47. And the Republicans, with one exception, Mark Crick of Illinois, every other Republican in the Senate voted that bill down. They said, no, we must arm ISIS. If you have a Republican senator, and it's not Mark Kirk of Illinois, your Republican senator just voted to arm ISIS. They said, we're not going to let them fly. We're not going to let them sit next to you in the cabin for fear they might spill their food on you or, I don't know, maybe strangle you because they're dangerous people. But we will let them walk into malls with semi-automatic weapons of mass destruction. They can mow down your kids sitting in the line for Santa, but they can't come on your planes. Because, you see, flying, and it's not flying, they're not flying the planes, sitting in a plane next to you, Republicans consider to be more dangerous than mowing down kids in Newtown, Connecticut, or at an office party in San Bernardino. Now, that's some sick stuff. That's really sick thinking. It's not logical, obviously, if you believe that no one on the no-fly list should be denied the purchase of some extremely dangerous weaponry, then what's the purpose of having a no-fly list at all? If all the people on the no-fly list are innocent, then they should be allowed to fly. Now they said, well, you know, there are some people who have been mistakenly put on the no-fly list. That's true. And you have a right, by the way, if you have been mistakenly put on the fly list, if they've got your name, which sounds like someone else, you write them a letter, you say, I'm not that person, and you get off the no-fly list. It happens every day. The vast majority of people on the list are people that the United States of America believes are terrorists. And the question I have for Republicans and irresponsible gun nuts all across the country is why they want terrorists to own these weapons. Why do they want to arm ISIS? How dare we blame Saudi Arabians for arming ISIS when we have Americans right here in this country, including every single Republican in the Senate save one, who also wants to arm ISIS right here in America? Think about that. Now they're doing it for other reasons. They're not doing it because they want to see ISIS kill Americans. They're doing it because their constituents fear that somehow if we take guns away from ISIS terrorists, we're going to take guns away from responsible gun owners. And that, my friends, makes zero logical sense. But these aren't opinions that are formed by logic. They're opinions that are formed by emotion. By people that say, oh, we have a black president. Get your gun, Annie. People who are losing control, often middle-aged white men of limited means who are losing their jobs and increasingly suffering in the increasing inequality that's in America. And rather than blame Wall Street or the Republican Party, they'd rather blame immigrants and blacks and anyone who doesn't look like them. But it's a false sense of control. If you own a gun, it's about 20 more times likely to be used against you or your family than an intruder. People say, Mark, 30,000 deaths a year, 100 deaths a day, but half of those are suicides. Well, that's true. Half are suicides. I submit it's a lot easier to commit suicide by putting a gun to your temple, shooting yourself in the head, than it is by scratching your wrist with a razor blade. Most people who shoot themselves with guns do succeed. Most people who cut themselves with blades actually fail at suicide and often never try it again. That's still only half the deaths, 50 a day, by suicide. 1/6 are done by accident. Accidental deaths, 16 deaths today and every day. Little children killing other little children. A gun owner forgetting that there's a gun in the chamber when you empty the bullets, shooting himself or a family member. And yes, 1/3 of those are murder, plain out murder, 10,000 plus murders a year. All because of guns. And in this context, where 100 people every day are dying at the hand of guns, where 30-plus people are murdered every day in America at the hand of guns, I have to ask, is the 14 dead in San Bernardino that extraordinary? Should we go to war in the Middle East because 14 died at the hand of a terrorist, but do nothing when 9 are dead in a black church? When 10 are dead and or so in Arizona, including a Congresswoman, Gabby Gifford, shot. When I don't remember how many died at Newtown, I think 27. I could get my numbers wrong. I apologize if I do. It was 20. Okay. 20 little kids, I've been told. I forget how many died in the Aurora, Colorado theater. I'm sorry if I can't keep track of every one of these death tolls that occur every single day, every single week, every single month. But I have to say this. ISIS, you got nothing on Americans. You ain't killing 1/10. You ain't killing 1/100 of the number of Americans we Americans kill. Sometimes people who are mentally deranged. Sometimes it's gang violence. Sometimes it's people who are domestic violence abusers. But as far as terrorism's concerned, I'm sorry, ISIS. You can't scare me. You can't scare me any more than a deranged shooter in Virginia Tech or the other killer in Virginia who wanted to be in the national news. That's in my home state. So why is ISIS getting us all upset and scared? You want to be upset and scared, you have good reason to be, but not by terrorists. The chance of you being killed by terrorists are tiny, particularly compared to the chance of you being killed by your own homegrown gunman, your own mentally deranged person, the own person who would have failed a background check, except that your Republican representative said that I don't want there to be background checks in America. Oh, I want them. I'm fine with them for the federally licensed firearm dealers. But if you want to get a gun over the internet, you go right ahead. You want to get 6,000 rounds of ammunition, you go right ahead. You want to go out and commit mass murder in America, that is a constitutional right, some Republicans seem to be saying. It's not. It's not even a constitutional right to bear arms. I know. 5 Justices of the Supreme Court says it is, but apparently they can't read. The Second Amendment says you have a right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia. I'm sorry, none of these mass murders were committed by anyone in any well-regulated militia. So let's all calm down a bit. Let's all recognize that ISIS ain't good. But number one, We do more damage in America with guns to ourselves, and unless we change America's gun laws, there's no way of stopping ISIS in the United States. And number two, we can't stop ISIS abroad unless we get rid of the factors that cause ISIS in the first place. They're not killing us because they hate our freedom. They're killing us to get attention, because hundreds of thousands of innocent people are dying in Syria. And if we don't do anything about that, we're not going to stop ISIS abroad or at home. This is Mark Levine, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I'll get back with your calls right after this.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Who says nerds can't be fun? It's Mark Levine.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Poor Reggie from Georgia has been hanging on since the very beginning of the show, but I had so much to talk about that I'm only now just getting to you, Georgia. So, Reggie of Georgia. So I apologize, but there you are. You've got the floor, Reggie. Welcome.
Welcome. Happy Monday to you too, Mark.
Happy Monday.
And why is it that whenever President Barack Obama tries to do something good for this country or for the entire planet, the Republicans always seem to go from attacking and criticizing him to opposing him and stopping it each and every single solitary step of the way, you know, without even thinking about the consequences of their actions, you know,
even in the near future. They're not even afraid of inconsistency. You know, it's one thing if you have a strong philosophical reason to oppose the president, then, you know, this is a democracy. You should absolutely express your strong philosophical reason. But the Republicans they're all just about saying no. You know, President Obama wants to do nothing in the Middle East, and they say, no, do something. And then he goes and says, all right, let's stop Syria from poisoning its own people. They say, no, don't do that. And then he says, okay, well, we'll hold back and do that. Well, you're not doing anything. Well, now he's taking action against ISIS, and he wants their military authorization. They say, no. It's like they're like a petulant child. It doesn't matter what President Obama does, they're against it.
Yeah, but why don't they make up their own damn freaking ever-loving mind?
Because they don't have any suggestions or proposals of any kind. There are a few that do. There are a few that do. I disagree with Lindsey Graham on a lot of things, but he has his own proposal. John McCain does. They're not many, though. Certainly not Donald Trump. Certainly not Ted Cruz. Certainly not Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or any of them. They're very, very few that will actually state their own proposals. They'd rather just attack Obama.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about that. What are their proposals?
They don't have any, other than Lindsey Graham, who actually, on this particular issue, I think he it's not quite where I would go, but at least it's closer. But the vast, and of course, he's 0% in the polls and doesn't matter. Donald Trump, when you ask him about his plan, he says, I got a really good plan. It's going to be huge. I mean, I'm only mocking him a little bit. If you listen to him, he says, you don't want to, one reporter asked him, he said, you don't want to know what my plan is. They are going to regret it. I am going to destroy them so badly. You know, he reminds me of what an 8-year-old might say. If you ask the 8-year-old, what's your plan to destroy ISIS? Well, what's he going to do? Nuclear weapons? What are you going to do, Donald? He won't say. You know, Richard Nixon had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam when he ran for re-election in 1972. And right. I remember when I studied history thinking, that's ridiculous. What idiotic American would believe and vote for that? And here we are, 50 years later, and Donald Trump saying, I got a secret plan to fight ISIS. Well, you know what a secret plan is? It's called no plan. No plan at all. He has no idea. And that's what we have from the party of no. The party of no Obama and no ideas. And that's why I think they will lose in 2016. This is Mark Levine. I hope you enjoyed the discussion today. If you want to comment, go to my website, marklevinetalk.com, or just tweet at me at Mark Levine Talk. This is Mark, signing off.